Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast.
Today I'm talking with Ian Griffiths, Pluralsight course author, independent consultant, and one of the brightest individuals on the planet. Ian?
Hello, thank you for that very generous introduction.
Well, I've known you for a number of years, and what I have found is that talking with you, whether it's by email or now by voice, is always valuable. And plus, I owe you a debt because you took my book, Programming C#, which was in desperate need of resuscitation, and did a brilliant job on the fifth edition. So thank you.
Oh, well, you're too kind of thank you for the opportunity to take it over. I'd always wanted to write a book on C#. So yeah, I was happy for the opportunity.
Now, I remember that we had a lengthy conversation about the proper way to pronounce and to think about the equal sign greater than combined operator for link. Do you remember that conversation?
Oh, just about, yes. That was what I think I was advocating, calling it something goes to something else at the
time. Yes, goes to, that's right. And I've been using goes to ever since. How do you have it in your brain now?
That's still how I think of it. I was just trying to remember if I'd changed my mind since, but no, that's what I think of it now. So that seems to work for me.
I spoke with somebody recently who doesn't think of it at all, which I thought was the most intriguing solution. I don't know what he does. He doesn't have a little word in his brain, which I find. Sometimes I think of it as yields, but goes to seems to work.
Yeah, I think yields could work. I just think I probably wouldn't use that in C# because there's already a keyword called yield.
Right. Oh, and then the other way I think I was arguing for was such that. A such that. A dot.
Okay, yeah, I think I probably would have objected to that at the time and still would now on the basis of such that has a specific meaning in set theory.
Yep, so, that was your 2.5-page exegesis on why I should stop. So you have been immersed in C# since C#1 at a minimum, and now have written the C#4, what I would think of as the definitive text, but I may not be objective about that. And have you started looking at C# beyond that?
I certainly have, yes. So I didn't make it to PDC this year, unfortunately, but Microsoft generously, you know, broadcast the entire thing for those of us who are sat at home. So I was glued to my internet connection watching the Anders talk about the new async features in particular. And I've actually downloaded the async CTP and I've got that running in a virtual machine. So I've been playing around with that. I've written, I think, only one blog entry on it so far, because I think by the time I'd got my head around it, a bunch of other people had already started to write blog posts, so I wanted to avoid doing me too things. But I've been playing with it, and I think it's going to save me a lot of time. Is the main response I had to it.
And the idea is to simplify asynchronous communication or asynchronous callbacks within C#. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yes, so whether it's communication or I/O, it's basically any time you want to do something that's going to take a while, and you'd like to avoid just sitting and waiting for that to finish on the thread that started the work. So I think what's interesting about this is that it's relevant for both client-side code, which is my main area of interest, but also on the server as well, although for different reasons. So on the client side, we obviously want to avoid hogging the user interface thread, because if you keep the thread that's responsible for the UI busy, that thread can't process user input, and consequently your user interface looks like it's hung for as long as that thread is doing stuff. So if I do something like, please go fetch this thing from this URL on the UI thread, then my application will freeze till that's done. On the server side, it's sort of slightly less of an issue often, because we already expect remote requests to run slowly. So, you know, the server is going to take as long as it takes to handle the request, but there are scalability issues there. You don't want to have too many threads blocked waiting for something to happen, because that can start to cause the server to grind to a halt. So there is also a role for doing asynchronous processing there as well, if you want to increase the extent to which the server can handle multiple requests concurrently. So I think this is going to be important for both. And really the great thing about it is that not that it enables this technique, because you've been able to do this since .NET version 1 with the asynchronous programming model, you know, the whole begin something, end something pair of methods. It's always been possible to do that, but it's been a bit of a pain, because you tended to have a disconnect between the logical sequence of events, or the logical sequence of processing you wanted to do. So you might say, get this information from here, then do some processing on it and decide what to get the next piece of information from based on what came out of the first piece, and sort of combine stuff together and feed out a result. There's a series of steps there which logically may form a sequence, but if you wanted to make them work asynchronously, you ended up having to carve them up into separate methods, which got awfully messy.
So let me just interrupt you for a minute to make sure that we're all fully on the same page with that, which is that in the original and up until now way of doing things, what you would do, to see if we can sketch this out in air without getting too confusing, is you would have a main, let's say, a main function, your first method, and it would say, get customers. And it would pass in the name of a method to call when that's completed. So we'll say that, we'll just say that's called get customers completed. Mm-hmm. And then if you wanted to take the first and last name and combine them, and for some reason you were delegating that to a service, I don't know, because it does a lookup for nicknames and such, or making that silliness up, then what you would have to do is not say get customers and then in the next line combine name. You would have to say get customers, here's the callback, which is get customers completed. And then in get customers completed, you would have to call combine name. And then
yes,
if you wanted to do anything with that, you would have to do it in combine name completed.
Exactly,
and
yes.
And assembling the whole thing back up in the first method was difficult at best. So that's the problem that this solves.
Yes, exactly that. So to be fair, it did get slightly easier with earlier versions of C#, because back in the C# 1 day, if you wanted to have multiple methods, they had to be completely separated out in the code, whereas with C# 2, we got anonymous methods, which meant that you could at least arrange for the callback method to be kind of in the same scope as your original method, which means that all of your local variables would still be available to you. You didn't have to kind of note down somewhere everything you were doing when you started the method, started the work, just so you can remember what you were doing when the completion method was called, and then carry on from there. So anonymous methods helped a bit, but they still ended up kind of looking like a bit of a mess once you started to have more than sort of one callback involved.
And so what happens now with the new async method? How is that different? How does that flow?
Well, the way it looks now is that you pretty much write the code in the order in which you want things to happen. So, for example, you would have a call to a method that gets the name or whatever it is you're going to get from the remote service, but you would precede it with a new keyword. So you would say await get name. So string name equals await get name, or begin get name, whatever the method is going to be called, or get name async, probably, is what they're likely to call it. They haven't quite nailed down the naming standards yet, but it's probably going to be await get name async. And that await keyword says this is going to take a while. And ironically, I think it's a slightly weird name, because ironically, the thing that await does is says, well, let's not hang around and wait for this, which is more or less the opposite of what it actually does. You'd think await would say, well, okay, let's stop for a while and not do anything more until this thing comes back.
Exactly. What it actually, sounds like the kind of thing you put on a lock.
Yeah, but actually, of course, that's exactly what synchronous methods already do. You know, if you use the blocking synchronous versions of an API to fetch data, they already don't come back to you until they're ready with the data.
Right.
The asynchronous ones return before they've got the data. Await does something sort of in between. It does allow your method to return immediately. So essentially, it hands the thread back to the caller. It returns from your method. But critically, here's the different thing, is it remembers where you got to and automatically builds the callback function for you. So under the covers, it takes what looks like a single method, which does one thing after another, but it actually splits it up into multiple ones, using the callbacks we'd have to do by hand today, so that you can say, well, okay, here's where I want to carry on once I've left off. So as far as your programming sort of idiom is concerned, you call await do this thing, and then when it returns you the information that it's fetching, your method just continues. It carries on from exactly where it was before. So you've not had to split your code up, put extra nested methods in, split it across multiple methods, do any of that stuff. It just looks like one thing after another. It's just that it kind of left off for a bit and then carried on later. It picked up from where it was before. So that's one way you could think of this.
Let me stop you there for just a second so I can get this picture clear in my head, which is that I say await some method. And then the line below that is not going to execute until it comes back.
Correct, yes.
So what lines will execute while that's happening?
It'll return to the caller. So if, for example, the code we're discussing was in a click handler for a button, then you just would return immediately without waiting for the work to complete, which means that if you're on the user interface thread, that thread can then carry on processing user input and your user interface will remain responsive. And then at such time as the work finally completes, that's when the rest of your method runs. So it allows the method to run in pieces, sort of.
And does await have a scope? Do you need to put braces around all the things that are within that?
No. One of the great things about this is that it avoids cluttering up your code with lots of different pieces of scope. So you do have to mark the method itself as being async. So there's an extra keyword, async, which you stick on the method. And that basically says to the C# compiler, I'm going to be using these new asynchronous features. And it's also a signal for someone reading your code. They're going to look at that and go, oh, this method doesn't just sort of run from start to finish. It might run a little bit and then kind of return to the caller. Then later, a bit more of it will run and then it will return to the caller again. Then a bit more of it will run and so on. They know that it's sort of logical sequence may be interrupted by these await statements in the middle. But the await is just a statement. It doesn't sort of have a block that happens afterwards. The thing that follows the await is actually just an expression. So basically, you're saying, I want to get some data by invoking this asynchronous function. So you say string name equals await get name async or something like that. And then, yeah, there's no extra scope involved. It just means that the execution will sort of stop and return to the caller at that point. And then later it picks up from where you're left off. It looks like you're doing one line after another. There's no need for lots of extra curly brackets.
Which is terrific. And the thing that is making it all fall into place is that it's the entire method in which the await appears that is going to have this behavior.
Yes.
So it's the method that returns. The method that surrounds the await call is what returns as soon as it hits that await.
Absolutely, yes. And, you know, I think I'm probably in danger of making this sound much more complicated than it is because I love to talk about the details of how things work under the covers. I think the critical thing to remember, though, is that the point of this is it makes your code look very simple. You end up with code that doesn't look like it's anything particularly special at all. You just say, go get this thing. And then after that, feed that into this other thing. And then when that comes back with some more data, go do this thing instead. It looks like perfectly ordinary code. It just happens to execute a bit differently. So it really is very simple to use, very simple to read, and the C# compiler does a lot of work under the covers to restructure that code to make it do what it needs to do to be able to go take a break in between all the slow bits.
So let's make the assumption that I will put on the page associated with this podcast some links that you recommend, and one that I'm fond of, which is Mads Torgersen's Channel 9 interview about this, mm-hmm. So that folks who want the details or who are perhaps having a little trouble envisioning this can go there. And let's feed your tendency to go beneath the covers and talk a little bit about what's inside all of this.
Okay, so I would say the most important thing that people who are interested in using this at some point in the future should be looking at now is a part of the .NET class libraries that was actually added in .NET 4. So it's out there today. You can use this today. You can learn it today. But it's actually what provides the underpinnings of a lot of this new language feature. And it's something called the TPL, the Task Parallel Library. And this is a bunch of stuff that lives in the system.threading.tasks namespace. So there's quite a lot of the threading chapter in the C# book is actually dedicated to this topic. So that's one place you could learn about it, but there's a lot of stuff online as well. And the whole TPL model, the whole task-oriented model, is actually central to how the C# compiler rewrites your code. Because when you start doing this sort of work that is logically, you know, one unit of work, a bunch of steps that logically represents one thing you want to do, but which is actually carved up into multiple distinct pieces, each of which could take some time. Some challenges emerge. You might want to be able to look at that and say, well, how's it going? You might want to say, you know what, that's taken too long. I want to cancel it. I'd like to give the user a cancel button, or maybe on the web server, I want to give this so long, and if it doesn't complete within a minute, I'm going to give up. Or you might want to handle errors. Error handling gets horribly complicated once you start having several different related bits of asynchronous work. Well, the TPL actually provides solutions to all of those problems. The TPL provides a programming model for representing pieces of work which may be chained together. There might be trees of related work. It provides models for kicking off several things in parallel and then waiting for them all to complete. And it also provides a unified mechanism for exception handling that allows you to collect exceptions that may have happened anywhere in the little pieces that make up your asynchronous work and kind of handle those in one place.
I don't mean to interrupt you. I just want to break those apart because I don't want to lose them. And so I believe you mentioned chaining.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be using continuations.
There's a couple of ways you can do it, actually. Continuations are probably the most natural thing to use with this new C# language feature, because a continuation is a fancy name for a fairly simple idea. Basically says, do this thing, and then when that's done, do this next thing. And the next thing is the continuation. And the particular thing about continuations is that in languages that support them, you can usually write them in the same scope as the first bit. So you can write the first thing that might be slow, and then the second thing that will happen after that first thing is complete lives in the same kind of so syntactic space. And that's what the await keyword really enables. So continuations are the natural mode for this new C# language feature.
But the they have a very fluent-looking kind of syntax to them.
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of almost no syntax at all. In fact, if you're using the C# 5 syntax, if you're using C# 4 today, then yeah, there is sort of that kind of fluent style of API. So you can do, for example, taskfactory.startNew, and then provide a function that's going to run a task, then .continueWith, and then some more code. So it basically says, do this and then continue with that. So yes, it sort of reads fairly naturally. So yeah, that's one approach. But there is an issue with this, which is it does things in sequence, one thing after another. Sometimes that's exactly what you want, because that's an easy thing to understand than having everything happen at once. But sometimes you might want to have everything happen at once. It might be that your goal for going asynchronous in the first place is so that you can kick everything off at once, and then let everything sort of work in parallel. And then once all the results are back in, you can continue. So rather than saying the amount of time a job takes might simply be whatever the slowest thing is, because everything starts at once. And particularly if you're dealing with multiple different servers, you know, if you've got one web page that needs to hit four or five different services in your back-end infrastructure, there might be no reason to do the one after another. So continuations might not necessarily be important in that case. You might say, do all these things, then collect the results back in, and then proceed once they're all done. And the TPL also has support for that model, the idea of having one task that sort of fans out into a bunch of related tasks that are all simultaneous, and then you collect the results of all of those back in, funnel them back into a single point, so you can then generate your web page or whatever it is you're going to do as a response.
And is that related to parallel for and for each, or is that separate?
Well, parallel for and for each are one way that you can do that. They are useful when the work that you wish to do is essentially uniform. So you're doing lots of copies of essentially the same work, but probably with different parameters. So it might be, for example, you need to go and download data from 100 URLs. Well, the URLs might all be different, but the fundamental task of downloading the data is the same in every single case. So it's 100 variations on the same theme. Or it might be similar with something like calculations. If you are doing image processing, you're probably doing the same algorithm on a million different pixels. So it's, again, a million variations on the same theme. The parallel.forEach and parallel.for are kind of well balanced towards that sort of thing. But you could imagine a different scenario where you're trying to construct a web page and you need to get information about the logged in user that might come from one backend server. You might need to find information about their recent activity that could easily come from a different database server. You might have partitioned your services across multiple different things. So I went to a talk a couple of years ago by someone from Amazon who was talking about their server-side infrastructure, and he said that for a typical web page that you see as one page on Amazon, they may have gone and spoken to 100 different servers underneath the covers just to build the results, and they're aggregating the results from across all these different diverse things. Because, you know, they offer you recommendations, they show you recent activity, they might show you offers that are available to you right now. There's lots of different systems that might provide that. that might not be quite so uniform. There, you might actually have just sort of a fixed structure where I've got this service to get the user info, that service to get recent activity, and they're just kind of specific. They're not 100 variations on the same theme. They are 4 or 5 completely different themes, which you then aggregate into the one web page. And the nice thing about the TPL is that it supports both those models. You can have fanning out into lots of instances of the same basic idea, or you can fan out into several different completely unrelated things and join them back together again. The library provides the tools to do that sort of forking and joining. And then C# 5 is able to consume the way in which the TPL presents those sorts of tasks. It can consume those through this new await keyword, because the await keyword is able to work with tasks. So it's a very flexible idiom. It can support all sorts of different ways of structuring your work.
Are there things that you can do in 5 with the await keyword that you cannot do with the TPL, or is it a convenience?
Well, one thing I probably should clarify, because I can hear John Skeet's voice in the background here telling me that I've left out important details about how the spec really works. I should point out that the C# team have done what they usually do and have built a flexible system that is not too tightly tied to one way of doing things. So you're not tied to using the TPL. It is actually able to sit on top of other providers. They've documented what you have to do to enable some sort of asynchronous service to be consumed by these new language features. And the TPL is one of the things that is able to present that sort of face to C#. But if you wanted to build your own asynchronous engine, if you decided for whatever reason either the TPL doesn't meet your needs, or maybe you've been building your own one for the last 5 years and you just want to use that rather than having to rewrite your whole systems to switch to the TPL, then you can do that as well, because the spec tells you what you need to wrap that in so that the C# compiler can talk to you. The one, at the moment, the current CTP does have one kind of hook into the TPL, which is that if you ask the C# compiler to present what you're doing as a task in its own right, and you can do that simply by declaring your method as returning a task, the C# compiler will then generate code that wraps everything you've done up as a separate task that can then be consumed by other things. That is tied to the TPL. But as far as the asynchronous operations you can use is concerned, they don't have to be the TPL. So in a sense, the TPL is sort of is not the limit. The C# compiler is broader than that. Looking at it from the other point of view, though, the C# compiler itself doesn't actually have any real handling for asynchronicity built into it. In C# 5, what they've really done is defined some language keywords and said, this is how these keywords are going to interact with some sort of asynchrony provider. So they don't add anything on top of the TPL. If you consume the TPL, then the TPL's functionality is what you'll get, no more and no less. If you wrap it on top of some other system with some code of your own, then you'll get whatever that system provides, no more and no less. So really, the language is all about the idioms. And the same was true with link. You know, if you look at the link query syntax, it was a very similar story. Microsoft defined a bunch of operators, said, well, we're going to have filtering, we're going to have grouping, we're going to have ordering. And these are the methods that we expect to be able to call to get those services, and anything that provides those methods can use this new link-based syntax that was introduced in C# 3. And it's a very similar story with the async stuff. The async, when C# is consuming async services, it does so by saying, well, here are the methods I'm going to call. You better provide these methods, and they should work in a certain way, but it's up to you how the actual internal implementations work. So you can envisage multiple async providers in the future for C# 5, just like we have multiple link providers today.
So let me say something that is at least controversial and potentially just dead wrong, which is this. If you are a journeyman C# programmer, and so you have no plans of building your own asynchronous library, and you're actively looking forward to C# async and the await keyword, is it a fair statement to say that by learning the TPL and using the TPL, you have today all of that functionality just in a slightly more cumbersome form?
Yes, that is exactly the case. That's why I was suggesting people should look at the TPL today if they're interested in this stuff, because that's ultimately what it's likely to be based on, unless they're doing something advanced with C# 5. The normal case is it will be based on the TPL. So anything you learn about that today will serve you well in the future.
Is it accurate to say that the TPL, if your choice is to use lots of callbacks and then assembling things, using the TPL, even though it is not as clean or concise as what's coming in 5, will still simplify your code?
Very definitely, yes. So the couple of projects I've done since .NET 4 shipped, I ended up using the TPL on both of them, and yeah, it was a big deal. It made things a lot easier. And to be honest, the thing it really helps on is where things start to get a bit real. So things like error handling and composition of multiple pieces, those are the two things that tend to make the more kind of basic stuff like we have with the asynchronous programming model, the old begin this, end this model, that started to be hard work to combine. It's not that you couldn't do it, but you had to start coming up with your own answers to questions such as, what do I do when an exception is thrown? Where am I going to handle that? What am I going to do to shut things down in a orderly fashion once it becomes clear that this chain of work I've kicked off is doomed to failure because this step here has failed? These are complicated things to come up with a strategy for handling, and easy things to get wrong because there's all sorts of race conditions. And the TPL just does a lot of that work for you. So yes, I think today the TPL offers huge amounts of useful benefit to anyone doing anything even slightly non-trivial with the current asynchronous tools. So yes, I would absolutely go straight there rather than trying to fiddle around with the low-level sort of callback-based stuff.